Manage my energy. One of the ways that you can multiply your influence is you can manage your energy. I read a book one time by a guy who actually lives not too far from where we are right now, and he made the point that energy management is more important than time management. I think that's probably true. You can manage your time, but then if you're fatigued or you don't have the energy to do it, you may have a block of time, but you just want to take a nap, so you don't really get anything done. And I'm not against naps, by the way. Naps are a pretty good thing. I wish I could do more of it. Spurgeon loved to take naps, by the way. You ever heard the story about Spurgeon and his naps? Spurgeon would take his keys, you know, back in the old days, I guess it was like these old key rings with skeleton keys. I'd like to have one of those. And, you know, he would hold his keys out on his chair and he would lean back and he would fall asleep. But he would only fall asleep to the point that he would relax enough to let his keys fall. And so when his keys fell, it would wake him up. And that was enough just to give him that little moment of energy and refreshing that he had. So if you hear keys falling in the afternoon session, you know, it's because you're falling asleep with your naps. Now, Winston Churchill was the exact opposite. He took a nap in the bathtub with like a big bottle of bubbly. That I cannot endorse, okay, because I'm Baptist. Now, the Lutherans among you, you could do it. You would just feel guilty about the bathtub, all right? So a little denominational humor. Don't worry, Vineyard. I'll get to you too. So, Vineyard's like, nap, praise the Lord. We're not taking a nap. Heal somebody. Okay, so inner energy management is more important than time management. And I just tried to give a little energy boost to the room. That's what that was all about. Here's the thing. It's hard to be influential if you're tired. And managing energy is more than just resting well, although I think resting is part of that. Managing your energy is managing your life for diligence. It's managing your life for maximum output. We did a series, we've actually done it twice at The Journey, on the seven deadly sins. We're just going to keep doing it till our people deal with it. And as long as they keep committing the seven deadly sins, we're just going to keep preaching on it. You know that old joke about the pastor who preached the same message from last week, and so why did you preach the same message? Because you're still having the same problem. So we have done this series on the seven deadly sins a couple of times now, and I think about every 3 or 4 years, there's nothing wrong with redoing a series. One, you're going to do it better when you do it again. Secondly, they've all forgot it, you know, from 4 or 5 years. I mean, really, it's only 4 or 5 weeks they forget, but we'll just pretend that it's 4 or 5 years. And so I was just struck again when we did the series that one of the seven deadly sins is sloth. And a sloth is not exactly what you think it is. Because when you first look at the seven deadly sins, let me see if I can name them. Pride, anger, envy, greed, gluttony, lust, anger, pizza. I don't remember with that. But somewhere in there. But sloth is one of them. Okay? And so you're like, okay, I kind of get like, you know, that one, like pride I get, it's the root of all of them, you know, anger I get, but like where does sloth? And what I've learned is slothfulness is really the result of managing your energy very poorly. And what I'd like to do is quote from a sermon we did at The Journey on what sloth is. And I think Carrick Thomas wrote this, our executive pastor, and he'll be doing some things here with us. So I think this is Carrick's words. He said, sloth is much more than just being lazy. It's a deadly sin that attacks and slowly kills your career, your relationships, and your happiness. So what is sloth? Sloth, our fifth deadly sin, is the avoidance of physical or spiritual work. Isn't that good? Sloth is the avoidance of physical or spiritual work. Its opposite is diligence. For each of the deadly sins, we, you know, gave the opposite. Yes, sloth is the deadly sin that tempts you to be lazy, to leave things undone. But sloth is far more than just laziness. Sloth is where comfort wins over effort and you fail to do the right thing. Continuing, last paragraph. It is the sin that chooses the easy path instead of doing the right thing. Sloth is the sin that keeps you from doing what God wants you to do. It keeps you from making a difference, from living a life of significance, from being the person God created you to be. That's good stuff, Carrick. You ought to write a book on that. And like those other two books you wrote, let me put my name on them. That'd be even better. So diligence and having the energy to do what God wants you to do. Let me give you three ways to manage energy for maximum influence. Three ways to manage energy for maximum influence. Number one, work on major things during major hours. Some of you are still trying to get the sloth stuff, so let me let you catch up with me. Three ways to manage energy for maximum influence. Number one, work on there are no order, but first, work on major things during major hours. One of the things about energy management that I find interesting is that you naturally, just by the way you're wired up, have more energy during certain times of the day. And this changes over time, so you have to constantly evaluate. It changes as you get older and all of that. But the point is, you want to try to figure out what are the major times in your life, and then during those times, you work on major things. Most of us get it mixed up. We work on minor things during major time. So I've learned and grown a bit as a writer, and I've learned that if I write at 10 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock in the morning, I get about half of what I would do if I write at a different time. Now, I discovered that because originally I tried to write in the late afternoon, like 3, 4 in the afternoon, which most of the time I never got to it because I had so much stuff to do that it kept pushing into the day. So I could write more in the late morning than I could in the late afternoon. And now I've learned I can write a whole lot more in the early morning. So I can get like 2 or 3 hours worth of writing done between 5 and 6 in the morning than I could ever get between 10 and noon or 1 in the morning. And I hate it. I don't like it at all. I don't like getting up that early. My head hurts when I get up, and I don't feel really good. But man, after I'm done, I feel really great. So that's like, I've learned, that's like major time. Now, that's not necessarily sermon prep time. I do better in sermon prep at a different time. But I've learned to do major things during major time. And you want to begin to look at the rhythms and flows of your life and saying, okay, what do I need to do during that major time? And there are minor things that we all have to do. You know, following up on emails, following up even on stuff that is very important, but it doesn't require a lot of thought or energy engagement. You know, I hope you understand where I'm coming from on this, but sometimes like following up with prayer requests. Like I will pray for them, but I don't have to do that like during the major time because it doesn't take a lot of emotional or intellectual energy for me to do that. Or, you know, to respond sometimes to different staff requests and things like that. So you lump that during your minor time, and then you do your major stuff during major time. We could do an entire talk on that, and you actually will learn more on that as this week unfolds. So I'll leave it there. Number two, eat and drink for maximum energy. And here I'm basically talking about candy bars and soda. Just eat as many as you want, because the short-term result on that is fantastic. Like you feel really good when you eat a candy bar or soda for like 8.5 seconds. And then you feel really, really bad after that. So don't eat that. But you do have to eat and drink for maximum energy. I mean, you are all mature enough to know that there are certain things that you eat that right after you just want to take a nap. Then there's other things that you eat and right after you have some energy. And sometimes you have to choose what goes on your plate based on what you're doing after. And think that through. And then the same thing with drinking. You know, I'm not totally anti-caffeine. I've gone through major periods of my life where I've been off caffeine. My wife likes it a little better in the morning when I'm on caffeine. So, you know, I do caffeine in the morning and that's about it. But I've also learned that for every cup of coffee you drink, you better drink a 12-ounce or 16-ounce bottle of water. So one cup of coffee, one bottle of water, and then the rest of the day, drink water. Water is really powerful in the area of energy management. Some of you remember a few years ago, if you've been with me for a while, when I learned that when I get up to write from 5 to 6 in the morning, that if I start that 5 o'clock period by guzzling, because I can chug pretty good. I learned that in college. Actually, that's not true. I've never been a drinker. Not like that. But I can down a big thing of water, like a whole bottle of water. And like, so, you know, I go out there into my coaching cave and I have the bottle of water and I just like chug it like right at 5 o'clock. And then I get this like instant sense of masculinity when I crush that bottle. And I hope, like, did that wake up anybody else? You know, and I crush that bottle and then I sit down to write. And I don't know if it's the crushing sound of the bottle or the infusion of liquid. And it's the infusion of liquid, by the way, because your body loses a lot of water at night. You're dehydrated when you wake up in the morning. But I've actually found that it's given me like maybe 20 or 30 more minutes of extra focus. Because now I'm writing and this water is like going, you know, through me, and it's filling up my organs and it's filling up my brain and it's rehydrating myself. And then I've got to be done by 6 because, you know, I've got to pee. But nonetheless, it's a really powerful little tactic as it is. So we'll cut that out of the tape, I'm sure. We cut that out. There's a movie about that, about a radio commentator. Have you ever? It's got George Clooney in it. And he plays this guy who does these like 5-minute radio talks. And so before he does it, like, he's just doubting water. And then, like, he goes in and does his 5 minutes because he's just got to go. You know, and I've thought about that, like, as a sermon strategy for people on my staff who want to preach too long. You just make them drink, like, 6 or 8 bottles of water, you know, and then it's, like, you know, invitation time. And if anybody finds that movie, let me know. But it is really interesting because, like, I mean, literally, as soon as he walks out of the studio, he's just, like, making a mad dash, you know, down to the restroom, like some of you are going to do if I ever take a break here in just a minute. Whatever we're on, is practice the Sabbath. So work on major things during major hours, eat and drink for maximum energy, and then practice the Sabbath. Okay, let me try that again. I just totally like botched that. So 3 ways to manage energy is how it's pronounced. Thank you to my speech coach. 3 ways to manage energy for maximum influence. Work on major things during major hours, eat and drink for maximum energy, practice the Sabbath. The Sabbath is a 24-hour period where you cease from your primary vocation. I have talked about it in many other places. I believe we have an entire resource of just me talking about the Sabbath and what it is and how you manage it and what you do on your Sabbath. But here's the thing for our talk. In essence, when it comes to energy management, the Sabbath creates forced efficiency during the 6 days that you work. The Sabbath creates forced efficiency during the 6 days that you work and then allows for a full day of rest, reflection, and recreation on the day that you don't. It's like a little mini Sabbath seminar right there in a sentence. The Sabbath forces efficiency during the 6 days that you work. I got to get all these sheep in the pen. The Sabbath is coming. The sun's going down. I got to get my work done. And then it allows for maximum rest, reflection, and recreation for the day that you don't, because you don't do your primary vocation. So then you're able to enter the next 6 days rested and full of energy and maximized efficiency. So manage energy for maximum influence. All right. I'm going to do one more, and we'll take a break. Number 4, associate with the right people. An influence multiplier is association. Associate with the right people. Just like there are people that can pull you up emotionally, and there are people that can pull you down emotionally, We call the people who pull you up emotionally encouragers. You know, you speak courage into someone. You speak strength into someone. They can, just like there are people that can pull you up emotionally, encouragers, and there are people who can pull you down emotionally, discouragers, or the people who comment on your Facebook post, discouragers. There are also people, and see if you agree with this, there are also people that can raise your level of influence, and there are people who can minimize your influence. So here's what I call the principle of association. The principle of association. Your influence will expand or constrict based on the people around you. The principle of association says your influence will expand or constrict based on the people around you. And sad as it is, some people are unable to use their God-given influence because they are surrounded by people who constantly restrain, restrict, or constrict them. I looked it up to try to figure out which word is the right word. I've settled on constrict. But would you agree with that? First church I pastored was in Charlotte, North Carolina. Truthfully, it was on the north border of Charlotte and another little town called Harrisburg, North Carolina. But the church had a Charlotte mailing address. And I just felt a little more like esteemed that I was pastoring in Charlotte. So it seemed like a good thing. But here's the thing about the church. It was right by the Charlotte Motor Speedway. I think back in the day, it was still called Charlotte Motor Speedway. It's gone through a couple of names. Any NASCAR fans in the room? Like one guy in the back who reluctantly says, thank you to Zuline Press for being a NASCAR fan. You going to Daytona? Is that this weekend? Daytona this weekend? Chase Elliott? I like Chase. Okay, I digress. At that time, I'd known very little about NASCAR. I had assumed that NASCAR was not for me, but the church was right by the Speedway. Most of you know the story. They had 13 people on the night. They voted to call me as pastor. They were either going to vote to call me as pastor or vote to merge with the church up the street. True story. I don't think they made the right decision. They called me as pastor. My wife said there was only 11 people there, but I was counting us. So there was 13 people that were there. So I began to try to reach this community. And it wasn't easy. I was driving 2 hours to go to school at Duke University for my master's degree, 2 or 3 days a week, trying to pastor this church on the side. But somehow or another, God blessed. And most of the people, just by the nature of where this church were, most of the people were involved in NASCAR in some way. And so I got to know a lot about NASCAR. I got to learn about how the automobiles were painted, how sponsorships were secured. I got to know about the business. I got to meet several executives. We had a very famous day in our church one time where Dale Earnhardt came to our church. And the word got out. I think he actually brought in 10 people just over the next week because people said Dale Earnhardt was at that church last week. He didn't stay, but I did get to meet him and stuff like that. But I did reach a lot of NASCAR people. And over time, I actually became sort of the chaplain of NASCAR. I did some formal stuff with them, but also just a lot of informal stuff with them. And one of the reasons I was able to do stuff when NASCAR was in town is when they had a race at the Speedway, they closed the road in front of our church. So I didn't have anything to do on Sunday anyway, but go over and hang out with all the church members, at NASCAR. But during that time, I learned a phrase that stuck with me. And it's a phrase that comes from one of the most controversial decisions NASCAR ever made. And it's related to, and some of you may know this, it's related to adding a restrictor plate to the cars. How many of you ever heard that phrase? How many of you have a speedway near you that is a restrictor plate speedway? Because there are some that you don't have to have the restrictor plates. So some speedways, because of the nature of how they're laid out, they require a restrictor plate. And here's what a restrictor plate is according to, I think, NASCAR.com. For those not familiar, the restrictor plate is a metal plate with holes in it designed to slow the airflow into the engine, thereby reducing horsepower and speed. Depending on track conditions, NASCAR can mandate larger or smaller holes. But unrestricted airflow into engines at these super speedways hasn't happened in decades. Restrictor plates aren't necessary at NASCAR's other tracks. Either the tracks are too small or the banking not as severe to allow drivers to get caught up to the phenomenal speeds they do at Daytona and Talladega. And they say the concern was primarily for the crowd's safety because cars were going so fast that if they ran off, I guess they'd go up into the stands or whatever. But I learned this phrase, restrictor plates. And it stuck with me over the years. Is it possible that sometimes I do things that put restrictor plates on what God can do for me and through me and with me? And if I can be honest, I would say some of you are putting restrictor plates on your God-given influence because of the people you are associating with or the people you refuse to associate with. So the principle of association says your influence will expand or constrict based on the people around you. So who are you associating with? Are they restricting your influence? Or are they multiplying your influence? So with that in mind, let me introduce you to two phrases that maybe have helped to you. The first is a phrase that I've had to learn. It's a phrase called limited association. Limited association. These are people in your life that you can't avoid, because obviously if they're just harming you and you can avoid them, you're smart and you would just avoid them. But there are plenty of people in your life that you cannot avoid, that you have to deal with, but you can exercise what I would call limited association. And that is, as much as you can, you restrict your association with the people who restrict your influence. So limited association. And if there is someone coming to mind beyond your surprised mother-in-law, then this might be the time to think about, how do you limit your association with them? You know, you perhaps have people in your church that you have to meet with, but I would do it the minimum that I'm required to do. There are perhaps people in your denomination that you are required to meet with. Maybe they don't write you the check if you don't go to the meeting. But could you make it a limited association? And by doing this, you are limiting the negative influence that they have in your life. I've got some friends that I've had since college. To my shock and dismay, they've never read any of my books. They do not care that I'm here teaching to this enlightened group of pastors that are gathered here in Orlando. But I like to keep up with them. I do have a connection with them. And so I limit my association with them. You know, they get together sometimes without me, and it's fine, but I think they would consider me a good friend. But on my perspective, I'm limiting the time, because when I get with them, all they want to do is talk about how bad their church is, how sorry their deacons are. And I actually spoke in one of the churches, and he's right. I mean, they're pretty sorry. They want to run down the list of like all the other ministers that we know that they're doing better than. You know, oh, you talked to Tony lately? Oh, I hear he's really sucking it up over there at his church, you know. And I mean, you know, a little bit of that, you know, so I can keep up with their family. And then honestly, I know they pray for me, you know. I know they care about me and all that, but it's a limited association. I'm not going to go to like do a long guy's weekend with them because it's too dangerous for me. I mean, I could fall into that kind of trap. Limited association. You want to think about the people that you are spending time with. Because there's an old rule, and I know it's a little tricky, but the rule is you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. You're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. So some of you are pulling up the people around you, but unfortunately the people around you are sort of pulling you down into that average. So you want to avoid some of this. You can still be friendly. You can still love them in Jesus' name. Bless you, brother. Good to talk with you, but I ain't coming over. All right, bless you. And then, you know, the people that are critics, you know, that are critical, and unfortunately, this is my real beef with some formal education stuff. We don't teach people anymore to think critically. We just teach them to be critical. And I just want to limit my association with them. Now, do I try to influence them? Yes. Do I send, you know, signed copies of books to some of my college buddies and things like that? I do. Have some grown over time, and you know, I've allowed them into my inner circle more. Yes, of course. But I think about who is around me, who is speaking into me, and I try to have limited association with some of them. But then the flip side of that, the more fun one to teach, is intentional association. These are people that you intentionally choose to associate with because they will pull you up. They will expand your influence. And a lot of times this does require intentionality in your life. You know, I've got a friend in another part of the country, and I don't have his cell phone, but he is a major influencer. He is a major leader in our country and in the kingdom. But when I am in that part of town, even though I don't have access to that person by cell phone, when I'm going to be in that part of town, I can get on his calendar. And more times than not, when I'm in that part of town, I can have a lunch, or I can have a breakfast, or I can at least stop by his office for a few moments. And that lifts me up. I mean, just being around him and his perspective, you know, increases and multiplies my influence. And yes, I mean, you know, over time he has written a few endorsements for some of my books and things like that. But even if that wasn't the case, just to intentionally put myself around them. People say, how do you choose, you know, who the guest speakers are going to be at conferences like this, or the boot camp that I do, or these boutique events that we do from time to time? I say, I just think about people I want to spend time with. Let's invite them here. You know, you're going to get our speaker this afternoon. I got dinner last night with him. You know, I get intentional association with those people. And people say, well, you know, why do you keep doing like advanced coaching? Because I want to be intentional about being around that group. I mean, you know, the advanced coaching group, they gain a lot by being around each other, but I gain a lot by being around them. Intentional association. And this is why you have to go to things like this. This is why you have to be in networks like the networks that we have, because it puts you around the right people. Be intentional. And I hope you'll do that while you're here. At the beginning of this first day, I hope you will intentionally associate with some folks. Intentionally meet some folks. You know, I had those advanced coaching people stand up there earlier, not just because I want to congratulate them on their commitment to what we do in coaching, but because these are people that if you associate with them, I can speak from personal experience, they will lift you up. You will see some of our speakers floating around here, and the people that I've asked to do things, intentionally associate with them. And then the person beside you has wisdom that God may want to bring into your life if you will be intentional about associating with them. And remember, the guy who's teaching you this and telling you to do this is like Mr. Introvert. You know, my natural tendency is to go up to my room and read a book. And I do sometimes like books better than certain people, but not you. I've intentionally chosen this. People say, why did you create these networks? Because I wanted to have a choice on who I spend time with. That's why we don't make our events free. I want to choose who comes. But intentional association. So maybe you've thought of some people, and we'll just put sort of a punctuation mark on this. Maybe you've thought of some people that you need to sort of limit your association in Christian love. God bless you, but I'm going to limit my time with you. And then maybe you've thought, at least become aware of intentional association. Invest in leaders. Now, as ministers, we are, of course, called to take care of all of the sheep that God has placed in our flock. In my book on the Renegade Pastor, I remind you that as a pastor, you have a threefold role when it comes to your flock. That number one, you are to lead your flock. Number two, you are to feed your flock. And number three, you are to protect your flock. And when I talk about that in the Renegade Pastor book, I really do mean your entire flock. As a pastor, you are in charge of every person, whether they are first-time attendees or whether they are in the middle of your church, they're the most committed member inside of your church, you are responsible to lead, feed, and protect the entire flock. And your role, according to Ephesians 4:11, as a pastor, your job description, if you haven't read it lately, is found in Ephesians 4:11, is to equip God's church. And so part of our calling as an equipper is to ensure that everyone in God's flock is cared for. And so I want you to understand, I believe that, I am saying that. What we also see in the Bible, however, is a pattern for leadership development. So yes, we are responsible for the entire flock, but then it does seem that we are also assigned to leadership development. And so, simply put, as shepherds, part of our responsibility is to raise up other leaders. And so pastoring requires overseeing the entire flock, but then we must also invest a disproportional amount of time into raising up, investing in leaders. Now, from our perspective for this talk, from an influence perspective, our influence is multiplied when we invest a disproportionate amount of time in the leaders, both current and future, of our church. So, simply stated, when you invest in a leader, you multiply your influence. Why? Because when you invest in one leader, that leader then by definition is over 10, 20, 30 or more other people. And so when you invest in a leader, you are investing in a person who influences many. And so one of the ways that you multiply your influence is you invest in leaders. And that seems rather simple, but it does raise a question. Who are the leaders that God has placed around you? So if I ask you to identify the 4, 5, 6 leaders in your church that God has placed around you, could you identify them? Are you sure that they are indeed leaders in your church? And then, are you appropriately investing in them? So you want to be able to identify them. But then you want to identify not only the current leaders that God has placed around you, but who are the potential future leaders that you want to invest in. Maybe those are young leaders, or maybe there are people that are on the sidelines right now, but at the same time you're investing and equipping and multiplying your influence through leaders, you're also looking for those future leaders. One of the more controversial ideas out of the old church growth movement, and one that I still teach in the Growth Bearers workshop, is that as a church grows, particularly as a church moves from 250 in attendance to 500 in attendance, in order to break that growth barrier that we call the 500 barrier, the pastor has to make a mental shift in their mind. And so at 250 people, you can pastor a church, effectively lead a church, by being a good shepherd. Because a good pastor, not me, but like a good pastor can effectively lead a church of like 250 people. But there's really no pastor who has the ability as a solo pastor to effectively shepherd, lead, feed, protect a church of 500. So you have to move from what the old church growth guys called being a shepherd at 250 people to being a rancher at 500. Now the problem with that is the language. Because still at 500 you are the shepherd. We're not the chief shepherd in our church. We're the under-shepherd in our church, under the chief shepherd who is Christ. But then as an under-shepherd, we also raise up other shepherds. And that was the idea behind the move from shepherd to rancher. At 250, you do all the ministry through some level of leaders, but still, you know, you have your hand in everything. And then when the church moves to 500, you become the rancher. You make sure that it gets done, but you're primarily doing it through other shepherds. I've personally found that my sweet spot in managing leaders is about 4. I'm good at overseeing and leading and influencing about 4. So if you look at the org chart of the journey, it's me, and then underneath that or beside that or above that, however you prefer to lay these things out, there are 4 leaders. And then each one of them has underneath that 4 other leaders, and then underneath that 4 other leaders. And if you keep multiplying, that is very scalable and it multiplies very quickly over time. Today, because of the nature of the Journey Church as a multi-site church and my particular role in the church, I really invest in pretty much only the staff at the Journey. And then they invest in their, and really just even a certain selection of staff at the Journey, then they invest in the other staff and they invest in the other leaders. I'm still responsible for it, but I have to be very clear about who I am spending time with, who I am investing in. And so this is not only key to multiplying influence, but it is key for you to lead a growing church and for God to do what God wants to do through your ministry. So who are the leaders that you are investing in? And then who are the future leaders that you are looking toward, moving toward, and see as a future investment? With that in mind, here's some ways you invest in leaders. To invest in leaders, first of all, you have to spend time with them. There really is no shortcut with this. Leadership development, investing in leaders, best occurs face-to-face, knee-to-knee, eye-to-eye. Spending time with your leaders. Now, that doesn't mean always that it's spending time in meetings. But meetings are important. I was talking with someone on a coaching call just recently, and they were saying, you know, I have a staff person, but, you know, I'm having a tough time managing them, and they're not getting things done, and I'm not happy with how they're doing things. And if you were on that call, you remember as we dissected this, the issue was they weren't meeting with them. It's very hard to manage someone that you don't meet with. And technology is cool, and Skype is cool, and we use all of that at the Journey because of the way our church is structured and grown over the years. But you have to be face-to-face in a meeting with someone. And so meetings are sort of foundational. Meetings are where dynamic ministry happens. In fact, in another seminar that we have on meetings, we talk about how meetings are the playground of highly effective teams. And when somebody says they don't love meetings, what they mean is they don't love the way they've seen meetings done in the past. You know, I once went to speak at a church planter, at a church plant with a church that was growing fairly sizable. I've not ever told this story, I don't think, so let me just think a second. I went and spoke to a staff meeting at a church plant that was doing pretty good. 2 or 3 years in, they were doing pretty well. They invited me to come in for their staff meeting, and I got there, and they had a pretty good agenda, you know, which I give them credit. You got to have an agenda for a meeting, and I was first, and I did my little talk, whatever it was that day, I don't even remember. And then afterwards, the senior pastor said, we got a pretty full agenda today, but I tell you what, let's just scrap that. We're all going to go see a movie. Now, at first, I was like, hey, we're going to go see a movie. And then I thought, well, I'm not even part of the staff, so I guess they don't expect me to go. But they all went to see a movie, and there's nothing wrong with doing that from time to time. But this actually was a systemic issue in this church that they just wouldn't come together. They wouldn't get things done. You know, they were more interested in doing some of those, and the lead pastor had this idea that somehow an agenda-driven meeting, you know, was too constraining or confining, and they never really went anywhere. And I know that was just one snapshot, but it's kind of always stuck with me that, you know, you have to meet. We have to talk. We have to be eye to eye. And so there's no getting around spending time with your leaders. Now, it doesn't always have to be a formal meeting, but that at least should be part of it. And then a lot of times meeting with leaders means informally meeting with them. That's why I struggle with my weight, because I have a lot of breakfast meetings, I have a lot of lunch meetings, I have a lot of coffee shop meetings. The hot chocolate's really good in New York City. So, you know, we do a lot of informal meetings. But a large part of leadership, and where I was going with spending time with them, is taking them with you as you do things. So a large part of leadership is taking them with you as you do things. Because leadership, as I said earlier, is caught as much as taught. So if you're trying to raise up a team to help you with hospital visitation, take them with you as you go do it. If you're trying to raise up a team to go out and do kindness outreach or servant evangelism, take them with you as you do it. I remember being in Cincinnati with one of my early mentors, and since I gave you the city and talked about servant evangelism, many of you immediately know who I'm talking about. And he was trying to raise up a new servant evangelism team. And so it was come to this meeting, and I was going to talk about what we were doing in servant evangelism in New York City, and he was going to train them to do servant evangelism. And we had all these newbie people who come to this meeting to learn to do servant evangelism. And my mentor friend walked in with toilet brushes, gave everybody a toilet brush, and said, follow me, we're going to go clean toilets. And we went and did a servant evangelism toilet cleaning. But you haven't lived until you've done a servant evangelism toilet cleaning. I happened to go with a guy who had just gotten off work, and he still had a white shirt and tie on. So we showed up at the little Chinese restaurant right down the street from the church. They thought we were from the health department. We're like, no. We just want to clean your toilets. That's all we want to do, honestly, with that. No, don't go back there. So we did not. And I didn't go eat there after the training either. But in about 15, 20 minutes of going out and catching the spirit of servant evangelism, toilet brush in hand, we equipped a lot of leaders on how to do servant evangelism. So sometimes there's just no better way than to go do it. Let's do it together. So I try to drive this home a lot and should do more. As a pastor, there's very few things that you should do alone. Do it with someone as a leadership investment in them. And you know the pattern. The pattern is, first of all, you do it well. Secondly, you do it and somebody else watches. Then the third step is you do it with that other person together. The fourth step is they do it while you watch and give advice and feedback. And then the final step is what? No, you applaud. You applaud, okay, while they do it. So you got to spend time with your leaders, raising up these leaders. And one of the reasons you learn time management and you develop systems that we'll talk about in a few minutes in your church is so that you have the time to invest in your leaders. But at least, as much as is reasonable and possible in your ministry, don't do anything alone. You know, we don't write sermon outlines alone at the Journey. We bring in the new teachers on our staff. Let them see how we're writing sermon outlines. Take them with you as you go. Hopefully that sparked some thoughts. Second way to invest in your leaders is provide ongoing training for them. Provide ongoing training for them. When you read a book that is good, read it with them. When you listen to some audio that is good, listen to that audio with them. When I'm putting together resources and things like that for you, I try to think about how this could be used in your setting. So just recently, I did a revised and updated version of the assimilation seminar. We broke it down into 7 sessions. First time I'd done that in a resource, because more and more of you were telling me, this is how I'm using your resources. You know, we're bringing people together, we're listening. Now in the new assimilation, you can watch. We have a DVD of that. You'll probably see some of that floating around here. And you know, there's a DVD, so it's 30 minutes, your leaders, and you can watch it, take notes, and then you can apply it. You know, at the end of the senior pastor coaching or the stewardship coaching or assimilation coaching that I do, we just started another one on evangelism, there's a blueprint that you can take and use. And it's like, do this with your staff and leverage this. So you want to provide ongoing training. Now, this ties back to the meeting. So, you know, if you're building an assimilation team, you meet with that team and then you equip that team. Some things can be equipped on the fly, like, you know, toilet brush cleaning, servant evangelism. Other things require a little more formal training of going through some material, working through something. So if you build an assimilation team, study assimilation. If you're building an evangelism team, study evangelism. If you're building a small group team, you study a small group kind of stuff. But you've got to provide them ongoing training. And one of the gifts that you give your leaders is training. You give them books. You give them resources. You give them articles. You help them do, let me just say it this way. You balance leadership development training around helping them do ministry better as well as helping them do life better. So, you know, we tend to do one or the other. Some pastors, they have a team of people, a group of leaders that they're investing in, and it's all about their life, and they never get around to helping them with their leadership. Other pastors, and I tend to go this way, I want to just do leadership. Let's go over assimilation again. Let's go over the 4 boxes again. Let's just do all this stuff again. All the while, you know, I need to also realize that as a leader, I teach them to do life better and teach them to live out their faith at work and teach them to be a better parent or whatever it might be. But ongoing training, that's a very, very brief summary of things we talk about in other resources. And then from time to time, you might want to bring them to conferences with you. Bring them to conferences with you. And you can see this parallels the investing in yourself. You grow as a leader, so you spend time with other leaders. You read books and resources as a leader. You take a portion of those, the ones that you find most beneficial. You study them with your leaders. And then you don't come alone to a conference. You bring them with you. And when I personally first started doing conferences, I just wanted pastors. That's all I wanted. Senior pastors, I'm a senior pastor. Let's just get senior pastors. But then I've learned over time that there are certain events that we do. For example, our big mid-year event that we do every year, boot camp, it's now like half and half. Half senior pastors and staff, half other leaders that people are bringing to be trained in our 8 systems approach to ministry. And I've embraced that as part of your leadership development. And we are conscious of that when we put together that conference and lay out the calendar for that conference and how we present at that conference. So sometimes you want to bring them with you to those. But you have to keep associating with higher level leaders so that you can raise the leadership level in your church. And then you have to keep growing as a leader so that these higher level leaders are attracted to you so that you can invest in. And which means, fundamentally, the church will never outgrow you. So investing in leaders multiplies your influence. Leadership development is leverage. It's a type of leadership leverage that makes everything better. Here's another type of leverage. Number six. Leverage systems. Number six. Leverage systems. So if you have the list in front of you, number four and number five was all about people that you are investing in. Associating with the right people that can invest in you, you can invest in them. And then specifically inside of your church, investing in leaders. Well, this one is a little different take on that. So right people give you leadership leverage, but at the same time, so does right systems. And so what are systems? Systems are the processes that you establish in your life that increase your influence. So a system is something that you want to embrace because it is an influence multiplier. And as pastors, we need two types of systems. We need life systems and we need church systems. And in case you don't know, I could spend like 4 days on either of those because I love this idea. What are life systems? Well, life systems are systems designed to leverage the influence of your time, your energy, your finances, your priorities, and things like that. It's the personal side of life. And you need to develop life systems. And in many ways, like the foundational network, the Renegade Pastors Network, that is designed to help you with life systems. And over the course of this week, if you engage the Lunch and Learns and you engage the bonus systems, you will walk away with some new systems for managing time. Maybe even earlier, you got a few new ideas for managing energy. There are partners and sponsors and things here that can help you manage other parts of your life, but you have to develop life systems. And sometimes you can't implement the church systems well because your life systems are out of control. And unfortunately, I see that more and more, that sometimes pastors can't be effective at work because things are so bad at home. And it's like the old saying about, you know, never hire a real estate agent that has a dirty car. Because, you know, that may say something about them. Forgive me if you're in real estate. But, you know, the Bible says that in order to be an effective leader, you have to manage your own household well. And so that's life systems. You know, systems for your health, systems for your time, system for your finances, for your priorities. So life systems. But then you have to also learn to manage and build church systems. And this is what we spend a lot of time on in senior pastor coaching and my system-specific coaching. And so church systems leverage the influence of the people that God has entrusted to you. And so an assimilation system is designed to help you create a great experience for first-time guests so that they want to come back and eventually grow and become fully engaged members. A group system allows you to have a stronger discipleship system or a stronger discipleship purpose and a stronger fellowship purpose. A worship planning system is good for your Sunday volunteers as well as your attenders. A good evangelism system is good for those in your community and those who have not yet heard about Jesus as well as the people in your church. So on down the line we could go, and I won't talk about the 8 systems of a healthy church, but there are 8 and you should know all of them and you want to implement them in your church and down the line. Now, with those two systems in front of you, life systems and church systems, here's my favorite definition of a system. And some of you have heard this. It's an acrostic in some ways, but a system for both your life and your church is a sustainable, scalable, repeatable process that saves you stress, time, energy, and money. That's what a system is, in case you haven't heard me say it lately. A sustainable, scalable, repeatable process that saves you stress, time, energy, and money. What's missing from that definition, as much as I like saving time, energy, and money and lowering my stress level, is that a system also increases your influence. Because a system, by definition, means you put a little bit in and you get a lot more out. So you put a little effort in and you get a lot more out. I like that. Put a little bit in, you get a lot more out. And the way a system works is that when you invest the time to build the system once, and then you invest a little bit of time to keep the system running, it will leverage your impact over time so that there are many people that are influenced through the system. So a little bit of input, a little bit of ongoing maintenance, a lot of influence on the back end. And I think that's a pretty good return. I mean, I remember when we first built our assimilation system. I've been working on improving the assimilation seminar, and you'll hear some about that. But it reminded me of those early days of building the assimilation system. It took some work to get that going. It took some work to put it into our culture, to raise up our volunteers. But once we got it going, it has taken a disproportional amount of effort to keep it going compared to the thousands of first-timers that have gone through that system. So a little bit of work, a little bit of maintenance, thousands of people. So we have about 3,000 first-time guests a year come through the journey. Now, I think one of the reasons that we have 3,000 first-time guests come through the journey a year is because we built a good system, a system that will lead to about 40% of them coming back for a second time. That's our assimilation return. And then move them to regular attenders and eventually move them into small groups and move them into a membership. So it took some time to get it started. And when we were first working on it, we had no idea that would be the result, but that's what a system does. That's the power of systems. One system influences many. So you want to think about the systems that you need to build in your life. And if you need a better system for time management, build it. If you need a better system for energy management, find it. If you need a better system for financial management, go looking for it. And then I can help you a lot in some of those areas and help you a lot, especially in the 8 systems. So I won't say more about that. Just remember the power of systems. And I absolutely love it. If I didn't have it, I'd have to create it. Because I benefit greatly from it. In fact, people say, how do you have time to do this stuff that you do with coaching? It's because we got great systems. Got great systems at our church. I try to have great systems in my life. And I kind of will nerd out on these systems. So let's move on. So for the next one, number 7, let me talk about another way to leverage your influence. And number 7 is kind of going to be one of those that out of context, if you look at it, it would be which one of these doesn't belong. So just kind of prepare that I'm going to come at you sideways here for just a moment because you could kind of expect some of these others from me, but maybe you didn't expect this one. But number 7 is a big influence multiplier, and it's one I thought about not even talking about, but you cannot look, particularly at church history or in modern times, and see how leaders have multiplied their influence and not talk about number 7. So I want you to give it a fair hearing before you immediately judge it.